Yes.
Yes, I am.
Okay, we'll call the meeting back to order. We're under item 14, unfinished business. Ordinance for second reading. This is ordinance 2020-24, an ordinance adjusting the fiscal year 2021 budget for known changes. I'd entertain a motion to adopt this ordinance in its second reading.
So move.
Second.
Okay, motion's been made by Member Mucci, seconded by Member Lynn. And it looks like there are many changes, and I would imagine we need motions for each of these changes. Member Lynn?
Yeah. Mr. Mayor, if I could, I think the first four are relate to the CARES Act, and if it's okay with the Assembly, I would make those motions all at one time.
Okay, and then I'll read through what those issues would be. Is there a second to that motion?
Sure, I'll second that.
Seconded by Member Mucci. And the four items that we will group into one discussion item are decrease the budget amount for economic support utility subsidy program by $275,000. We didn't have as many applicants as we anticipated, I believe. Item two, increase the budget amount for economic support local business by $100,000, which will be used to pay back the economic fund for the local business grants totaling $100,000 in last April. Number three, increase the budget for the use of CARES Act funds to cover payroll for first responders through December 15th, 2020 by $150,000. Four, increase the budget for use of CARES Act funds to cover payroll for the EOC through December 15th of 2020 by $25,000. I think that, does that cover your motion, Member Lynn?
It does, thank you.
Is there discussion on that motion?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Mayor. I had asked the finance director just a couple questions just regarding who is covered under the first responders, and maybe if we could just fill that in just a little bit so the folks at home knew what we were talking about.
Sure, the first responders are the police, the fire department, and EMS.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Any other discussion on this motion to approve this change to the budget? Okay, hearing no input from the Assembly, will the clerk call the roll?
Mart?
Yes.
Chelsea?
Yes.
Dave?
Yes.
Bob?
Yes.
Jeff?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, that passes unanimously.
I have one more motion to make, Mr. Mayor.
Okay, Member Lynn.
Transfer $600,000 from the Electrical Fund Reserves to Blind Slough Capital Project Fund 747 to allow for the negotiation of a project deferment contract that agrees to pricing currently offered by the vendor and states that the start of the work will be delayed and contingent upon obtaining project financing.
I'll second that.
Motion's been made by Member Lynn to approve this transfer of $600,000 from the Electrical Fund Reserve to Blind Slough Capital Project number 747. It's been seconded by Member Mucci. Is there any discussion? Or would anybody want any clarification?
Could we ask Carl to explain the background behind this particular transfer of funds?
Are you available, Mr. Hagerman?
Yes, I am, Mr. Mayor.
Okay.
So, to explain this, the COVID has kind of really messed up this project. As the Assembly is aware, Power and Light has been working on improvements to the Blind Slough Hydroelectric Project for quite some time. We went through the process of doing a conditions assessment, which our engineering team let us know that there were several issues that should really be addressed before the facility fails altogether. No time frame at all of when it might fail, but it got us going on a project to refurbish the project. To that end, we had issued an RFP early on in the year to just procure the equipment for the work. And we did get five competitive proposals for that equipment. Unfortunately, COVID-19 did derail and postpone any consideration of a bond election and putting a question to the voters concerning that bond issuance and potential rate increases to repay that bond, just because of the economy, the economics right now are not fruitful. The other utilities have also put any rate increase discussions on the back burner until the pandemic is past us. However, so this, I had settled on decision to put this project on the shelf and had planned on moving in that direction, but in conversations with the engineer, Don Jarrett with McMillan and Jacobs had reminded me out what good pricing that we saw in the proposals and urged another look at this to potentially negotiate with the top-ranked proposer who offered a good price and a good product for the project and try to arrive at a contract that we could defer the actual equipment procurement. So in other words, we wouldn't have them launch on their engineering effort and manufacturing effort right away. They would hold off until the borough had squared away the financing end of the project, basically caught up after the pandemic was completed, and was able to move ahead, knowing that not only would we have an equipment procurement contract in place, but we could move towards construction or the installation of that equipment without worry about the finances being an issue. So where that puts us today is that the proposals that were opened earlier in the year were valid until December 15th, and we're rapidly coming up on that date. We have requested extensions, proposal acceptance period out to February 16th, and as of the time of this meeting, four of the five proposers had agreed to do that. So we can start negotiating with the top-ranked proposer, but the issue and why this is in front of the Assembly today is that in order to award a contract, even if we won't be paying the contractor for any equipment for up to 2 years from now, in order to make an award, the money has to exist in the capital project fund. Right now, the capital project fund is not, the balance is not sufficient to actually make this award. And with the process that is required to increase that capital project fund being a supplemental budget ordinance that takes three readings and roughly a month and a half to get to the end of, this is a good opportunity to transfer that money to the capital project fund and set the table for if negotiations are successful and a contract is arrived at, that will be brought back to the Assembly for approval and final award of the equipment procurement contract. If that is all successful, then the award will be able to proceed and not have an issue with inadequate funds in the capital project. As I said, this is not spending money today. It's a transfer from reserves to a capital project fund, and I will be bringing back a contract if we can arrive at one that is acceptable to all parties. I'll be bringing back a contract to the Assembly for final approval.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hagerman. Does that explain?
It does. Thank you, Carl. Question.
Any other questions of the manager, Mr. Hagerman, on this proposed transfer? Okay, we, I think, have addressed the, we'll have the clerk call a roll on this part of the budget change.
Okay. On the Second Amendment regarding Blind Slough. Dave?
Yes.
Mark?
Yes.
Chelsea?
Yes.
Bob?
Yes.
And Jeff?
Yes.
Okay, so that passes unanimously as well. Does the clerk feel we need to have a motion to, I mean, we've just address everything in the proposed budget change.
I believe we should have as amended, just to be correct.
I'd entertain a motion to approve the budget, 2021 budget for known changes with the two amendments we just voted on.
So moved.
Second.
Motion been made by Member Mucci, seconded by Member Lynn. Discussion. Clerk, call the roll.
Chelsea?
Yes.
Jeff?
Yes.
Bob?
Yes.
Mark?
Yes.
Dave?
Yes.
Okay, so it passes as amended. Next thing on the item is the discussion with Cecilia Tavallaro of Alaska Natives Without Land regarding the unrecognized Southeast Alaska Native Communities Recognition and Compensations Act legislation introduced to the U.S. Senate in November. Assembly Member Mucci requested Ms. Tavallaro be available for the Assembly to discuss any questions or concerns they may have regarding the unrecognized Southeast Alaska Native Communities Recognition and Compensation Act. And I understand there, Ms. Hollingstead and one other person is on the line as well. We will move forward as this is request. I would suggest that we try to do something like this that could be quite lengthy and have specific public comment in a special meeting in the future as this topic comes up again. But Member Mucci, or Ms. Cecilia Tavallaro, you may have the floor.
Operator, if you could please unmute Cecilia Tavallaro and also Nicole Hollingstead.
Are we going to unmute the third caller as well?
I'm getting the other number. I don't know how you got it.
Oh, okay. So,
and Ms. Hollingstead and Tavallaro are open.
Thank you.
Okay, so would you guys like to just give a little overview, or I don't particularly have any questions, but if maybe to answer questions if assembly members have them, we'll start off with Mr. Mucci because, you know, he requested this item on the agenda. So welcome to our meeting, and we'll see if we have questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Mucci.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Mark.
You're welcome.
Here then. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. You know, I asked to have this on the agenda like a week and a half ago, and part of the reason for having it on the agenda is, like the mayor said, we sat in on a meeting with Southeast Communities who had some concerns about the legislation, and frankly, the meeting that we had here on the Wednesday prior to when the public, I guess, are weighing in on our comments as a community, we did it on a Wednesday, and the comments were due a couple hours after the meeting. And when I left that meeting, I didn't have a real good I didn't feel well about how things came out, both, you know, as my participation in it. And since then, you know, it appears to me that there is some a little bit of time to kind of move forward with, you know, a community-wide on what we're looking at here in the Petersburg area. I mean, you've heard concerns from people who are talking about they can't see all the land selections on Midcoff Island, and there are some concerns about the land selections over at Thomas Bay. And looking at the property viewing app that we have on our website, it's really hard to differentiate where the land selections are and whose property they kind of either come up against. And I mean, I think there needs to be some clarification. I mean, I know there are lots of questions in the community, and this is probably not the right time to do it, but you know, one of the questions I have, and it doesn't have to be addressed today, is there is some concerns about who and how the lands were selected. We hear about economic development in the community, and I think it would be an interesting conversation to see what this organization, the plan is for economic development with some of these lands. I think for me, understanding the organizational structure of the landless organization as it relates to Petersburg, I think would be interesting for me. I think we need to also look at the Bureau of Land Management, Section 17B on their easement rules, and see what that means for access to the lands that we're currently using. And, you know, there's plenty of questions. We don't have to address them all today. I know there are plenty of things to do here. But my original intent putting this on the agenda was that things are moving forward faster than the community was comfortable with. And, you know, I would be certainly happy to have a work session or a special meeting in January and get some community feedback and some questions that they might have, and just keep the dialogue open, you know, in a constructive manner, and moving forward. So that's kind of why it's on there at this point. And so, yeah, I'd yield the floor to the callers. Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Tavolino, Ms. Hollingstead, you have some comments you'd like to make?
Yes, Mayor Mark, thank you. Mayor Mark Jensen and Assembly, we do have some comments. We can go ahead and get started with answering some questions that we have kept in mind that the Assembly members are interested in knowing the answers to. First of all, I would like to thank you for the time that you are giving us today. And if we do need to go ahead and call another special meeting, that would be fine with us. We want everyone to be on the same page and understanding where we are coming from. And it is, as we have stated in the past, it is good for the whole community. And all of the concerns we're hoping to address either today or in a future meeting. I would like to just point out that folks can see a more detailed map of our Petersburg and all of the other communities' land selections on our website, www.withoutland.org. And Petersburg's maps are under, if you go to campaign and the pull down menu, go into legislation, and you'll see our detailed maps. That was for one of the concerned callers in earlier. And also another concern was the bill number changed. No, there are two bills under the Senate side, and they are Senate Bill S-4889 and S-4891. And so if you would like to check in there, you'll get your answers. Also, we had heard in the previous meeting some questions were asked about how the lands were selected. And I would like to invite Nicole to chime in. Also, do we have Todd Antioquia on the line? And he was not unmuted?
I believe he called into the wrong number. Is he online now, Clerk Thompson?
He is on the line and he's unmuted, yes.
He is unmuted.
Oh, great, thank you. Well, I would like to invite my colleagues on this issue to chime in whenever possible to make issues clearer. The first question I'm going to address is how were the lands selected? And over 10 years ago, many of the landless shareholders from Petersburg contributed to the land nomination efforts over the decades, some of which are no longer with us. With the Congress makeup changing so drastically over the years, we had to revisit the maps countless times and make revisions and react to the shrinking availability of lands. Lands were selected for their traditional use, other spiritual and cultural reasons, for diverse economic opportunities, and for their accessibility. Now, many of the folks you remember, Dick Keto, Victor Guthrie, Mike Lopez, Gert Lyons, Amy Hollingstead, there are a number of folks that have been involved with this all throughout the years. I'd also like to point out, I don't believe any of the other communities that did receive village or urban corporations you just announced that you're going to be making map selections and or land nominations, and those folks that were interested showed up. And it's been a process over the years. So if Todd or Nicole would like to address anything regarding this land selections, please do.
They would have the floor if they have comments.
Thank you. This is Nicole Hollingstead. May I take this opportunity?
Yes, you have the floor.
Thank you so much. I am born and raised a resident of Petersburg. I'm currently living in Anchorage, but I still own property and pay taxes in Petersburg, and it's a pleasure to be able to speak to you today about this effort of Alaska Natives Without Land and to answer some of the more specific questions you have. But like Cecilia, I strongly recommend that there be a separate working session on this so that we can give you the detail and be sure to answer very thoroughly any additional questions you have. I do want to start simply by saying, for those who have called in with concerns and for the assembly members themselves, we hear you. We hear you. We understand that working towards community solutions necessarily means that there will be questions and there will be concerns, and that we have to have an open dialogue in order to make this effort successful. And to some of the concerns that were raised earlier, if legislation should not proceed simply because there might be contention among community members, well, then I'm not sure we'd ever get any policy to move forward. It's this form of public dialogue that we need in order to address those concerns and try to reduce any misunderstandings or misinformation. To the selection of land, it's important to understand that when the Tongass National Forest was formed, there were tens of thousands of tribal members who were forced to make the sacrifice of their indigenous homelands. There was a concern raised earlier about the sacrifice of taxpayers, and it's well worth asking. But I would ask also that those involved in this dialogue understand that these indigenous homelands were removed without recourse for those indigenous communities. And their community and societal infrastructures were reconfigured with that simple formation of the Tongass Forest. And when it came time to look at the land parcels, there were already over 5 million acres that were designated for wildlife conservation. There were over 7 million acres within the Tongass that were designated for other purposes, for forests and creeks. So when the communities that were left landless were setting out to determine their parcels, the only parcels we had left to choose from were those that were designated for economic development. So it's a little bit of chicken and egg. We did not select these parcels because of timber development. We selected many of these parcels because they were the only lands available for selection at that time. And I think that's an important thing to remember and understand. Will Ware spoke very eloquently earlier that we are no longer living in the reality of timber 1970s or 1980s. That is simply not an economic model that is sustainable. And when we say that we hear your concerns, we hope that we do receive the same respect in return, that how those lands are intended to be used is something that can be open for conversation, but ultimately is the prerogative of the landowner. I would like to also speak very briefly to access and assure all of those listening and those with any future concerns that the Landless Board has unanimously agreed that public access will continue on the lands that are selected. Every acre of the Tongass is precious to somebody, and it's not surprising that some of the selections include U.S. Forest Service cabins or recreation sites. I think what is remarkable to note that of the 155 cabins and over 160 recreational sites, that there aren't more that are included. And we do think there is reasonable recourse to be made for the very few, the five or six, that have found themselves in Petersburg's landless parcel selections. We are here because of our desire to work through the public input and information we've received, and in every case we're committed to working with the Forest Service to resolve specific site access and use issues. We've already asked to meet with delegation staff and the Forest Service to work through several issues related to specific public use sites. with regard to roads and trails, and with regard to public access to roads and trails, the legislation very clearly provides that conveyances of land shall be subject to these public easements, and that the BLM must consult with appropriate state and federal agencies. So again, just to underscore that unlike the original Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, this particular Alaska Natives Without Land bill preserves public access to all of the lands proposed to be conveyed to the new urban corporations. It guarantees in perpetuity that the land shall remain open and available to subsistence uses, non-commercial recreation, hunting and fishing, and other non-commercial recreational uses by the public. So again, we do hear you, and we ask that you hear us, and that we engage in a constructive, solution-oriented dialogue so that this emerges as a win-win piece of legislation for the community of Petersburg. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Hollingstead.
Thank you, Nicole. Thank you, Nicole. Also, Todd, do you have anything to add? If not, I'll go ahead and move on to the next one.
Yeah, I'll stand by. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, I'm just finishing up on who made the land selections. We do have a handful of community members, Petersburg citizens, of which even the Native stakeholders are members of. They are Petersburg citizens as well. None of the us and them. Expert stakeholders across the region, from Sea Alaska to the Forest Service to the conservation community to professional economic development advisors and beyond. They all participated in identifying available lands. And just to be clear, since I'm already spoken for, and we've been standing in line and aside for so long, we've got the crumbs to pick from. So that's, in a way, that's how so many communities had to pick farther and farther away from their homeland. So I'm moving on to the next question. Hopefully you have, I think Jeff asked what the organization structure will look like. Well, it'll be like the other 200 village and urban corporations that were formed under Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Each of the five communities will receive one township of land and stand up a Native urban corporation that will be autonomous. The rest of the state had more lands given to them, but because we did have the Tlingit and Haida settlement, they were giving us only one township. So that's what we have to work with. The shareholders who enrolled in a specific community back in the 70s will elect a board of directors from their shareholder base, and that board will hire a president or CEO or both to build the management and staff capacity to realize the vision of the shareholders and the board of directors. There is no connection to other regional, village, or urban corporations within the new company's governance structure. Does anyone have any input, Todd or Nicole? Hearing none? Okay, the next question, where does Sea Alaska fit in the organizational structure? The answer is they do not. Each of the five new urban corporations will be autonomous and be governed by the shareholder-elected board of directors and the management hired by the board to realize its vision. I believe there were some questions regarding, will Sea Alaska own the subsurface? The answer is yes. Just like the 12 village and urban corporations already recognized at ANCSA's inception, the subsurface will go to Sea Alaska, as this would be an amendment to ANCSA, not a whole new bill. Nicole or Todd?
Thank you, Cecilia. This is Nicole again. I do want to clarify that earlier today there was a statement about urban at-large shareholders. It's important that information be accurate when it comes before communities and the public assembly. There is a difference between urban shareholders and at-large shareholders. At-large shareholders were those who lived outside of the state of Alaska upon enrollment to corporations under ANCSA. The five communities without land were designated as potential urban corporations. And I just wanted to speak to that, that Sea Alaska's records have enrolled all of those shareholders in those five communities as urban shareholders. And while Sea Alaska, again, would manage subsurface, the structure of a corporation itself would be incorporated and stood up under the laws of the state of Alaska and run as its own separate corporate identity within the community of Petersburg. Thank you.
Thank you, Nicole. Okay, another question. The public invested in U.S. Forest Service cabins, roads, and LTFs, log transfer facilities, that would be on your new lands. How are those handled in the legislation? The Landless Board has discussed these sites and is in unanimous agreement that none of our communities supported the selection of these parcels because of the location of the Forest Service recreational facilities. As you know, public recreation sites are found throughout the Tongass, and it is impossible to identify large, continuous blocks of land that do not impact current public recreation areas. The landless communities do not intend to preclude public access to or use of U.S. Forest Service recreation sites. We have no desire to either remove or take over management of these sites. We appreciate the public input and information we have received as communities have reviewed the proposed legislation and the landless selection. In all cases, we are committed to working with the Forest Service to resolve specific site access and use issues, and we have already asked to meet with delegation staff and the Forest Service to work through issues related to specific public use sites. I would just like to add in there, I don't think Nicole already stated, we are not in a cabin grab, land grab. Like I said, this was a lot of the sites that were chosen many years ago. And also, we don't wish to be in the cabin rental business. Okay, so with regard to roads and trails, in regard to the public access to the roads and trails, the legislation provides that conveyances of land to the new urban corporations, quote, shall be, end quote, subject to the reservation of public easements under Section 17B of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Under Section 17B, the Bureau of Land Management is required to identify public easements across the land selected by Alaska Native corporations, including lands which are reasonably necessary to guarantee a, quote, a full right of public use and access for recreation, including camping, hunting, transportation, utilities, docks, and such other public uses, end quote. BLM must, quote, consult with appropriate state and federal agencies, shall review proposed transportation plans, and shall receive and review statements and recommendations from interested organizations and individuals on the need for and proposed location of public easements, end quote. Section 17B easements are reserved and managed by the federal government. The rights are reserved when the BLM conveys land to an Alaska Native corporation under ANCSA. Further, the legislation, unlike ANCSA, preserves land public access to all the lands conveyed to the new urban corporations, guaranteeing in perpetuity that the land shall, quote, remain open and available to subsistence uses, non-commercial recreational hunting and fishing, and other non-commercial recreation uses by the public, end quote. Again, this was not a requirement under ANCSA. The landless communities asked that this public access be included in the new legislation because we know these lands are used by many people. The legislation also preserves all existing special use permits and provides for the issuance of an additional 10-year special use permit to each permit holder. Additionally, each urban corporation will be able to issue special use permits on their own. The legislation also preserves the right of the Forest Service and its designees to continue to use the roads and LTFs and other transportation facilities conveyed with the land to the urban corporations. Several pages of the legislation are devoted to preserving public access, including public access to roads, trails, and to the land. Again, it's impossible for the landless communities to identify lands for conveyance without overlapping areas currently in use by members of the public. It is for this reason that the legislation has been amended to guarantee public access. But Nicole or Todd, would you care to add anything?
Yes, this is Todd. And if I may, Mr. Mayor, Gunnell Chase, thank you. This is Todd Antioque. I'm the campaign and volunteer coordinator for the Alaska Natives Without Land. And greatly appreciate yourself and the distinguished staff members for allowing this time with you all. We greatly appreciated the, you addressing the matter also in the last regular assembly meeting, as well as hosting the work session on November 18th, where we were provided the opportunity to present the legislation. And I just wanted to add to Nicole's comments that Ms. Tavallaro provided a written response to a number of comments around these issues related to access, the at-large benefits, and numerous others that were brought up in the public testimony. And it was submitted to the Assembly on November 17th, so the day ahead of the work session. And it has a comprehensive outline and all the factual basis for correcting a number of those assertions. So we're happy to re-forward that to you, and again, you know, greatly appreciate too the opportunity for future work sessions should they be provided. So, Sheesh, thank you.
Thank you, Todd. If I may continue, we're just about ready to open up for questions from the Assembly as necessary. The next question, what are the next legislative steps? The legislation received a hearing before the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Subcommittee, Public Lands, Forests, and Mining. We hope to see a similar hearing in the House and then for the committees to mark up the bills, deliberate, and then pass them on to the full House and the Senate. We would greatly appreciate a Christmas miracle. And like I said, we tend to think of citizens of Petersburg as being one and working together. In this day and age, it would make very prudent sense that we would work together for the common good of all and pool our resources. And I'm hoping that that because we are answering questions and being available to answer any questions also, that there would be a development of trust in amongst our people who are involved in putting this whole thing together. We want the best outcome for everyone involved. And that means the whole rock, Nikoff. So appreciate it. If you have any questions, we'd be happy to answer. Thank you.
Any questions from Assembly members? Mr. Kensinger, or Member Kensinger, or Trembley?
Yes, Mr. Mayor, I have one question.
Okay.
At a previous meeting, I asked if you were interested in having a covenant placed on this land in regards to logging, that you would abide by federal logging standards and not state logging standards. Is that something that you would entertain, or is that a non-starter from your perspective?
I'm sorry, who is speaking?
That is
Dave
Kensinger.
Dave Kensinger. Yes, if you do not hear the question, I'll repeat it again.
No, I heard it.
You
were talking about abiding by federal logging practices rather than the state?
Yes, specifically in regards to federal logging standards require that all timber be processed in Alaska, and it also has limitations on the streamside buffers instead of 50 feet mm-hmm. to 100 feet, and it also restricts the size of the clear cuts. That's just a snapshot of those regulations. The state logging regulations basically state that you can pretty much do whatever you want as long as you don't log within 50 feet of a stream.
Oh.
And, of course, you don't require any local processing.
Mm-hmm. Well, first off, I would like to state that, yes, we would like to be abiding by the most stringent any kind of logging, but at this point in time, we don't have any ideas on logging any of the proposed land land selections for any of the five communities. I, of course, can only speak right now specifically for Petersburg because we do, back in the day when those land selections were being made, over 10 years ago, we didn't have any real ideas or plans on logging. However, that's not to say, you know, I don't know, down the road, I don't know. The timber industry is not something that we're interested in. And I'm telling you right now that our young people are very concerned about the carbon imprint on our planet. A lot of people are paying attention to what's going on with the climate change. And so what we would like to see is we'd like to be included or very, very seriously consider the carbon credit that we would be able to enjoy like some of the other village and urban corporations are enjoying now. We have ideas on ecotourism, cultural, social benefits, educational benefits for our shareholders, and to be honest with you, if there is, I believe there can be a limited amount of logging, even though there are carbon credits in place. But I personally would, I don't foresee anybody wanting to do that. It doesn't make sense in this day and age. So, carbon credits and limiting our carbon footprint on the planet. We have a lot of young people who are very savvy to all of this and what's going on, and this is going to be their corporation. They are in your communities. You know them, and you respect them in Petersburg, and one of them did call in and speak here just fairly recently. Will Ware has a business in Petersburg, and he's very opinionated, as you may have noticed. But we appreciate him calling in and giving support for us. But yes, I believe that it wouldn't be unreasonable for any of the five urban corporations to consider the most stringent protections under federal logging practices. Todd or
Mr. Mayor, can I ask a follow-up?
Sure. We're into this about an hour.
So my understanding is the answer to your question is yes, that you would not be opposed to a covenant being placed in this legislation to that effect.
Mr. Mayor, this
putting
is
it
Nicole
in the legislation?
Yeah,
go ahead, Nicole.
Yes, I would not want there to be a misunderstanding. The truth is, Dave, this body is working very closely with communities to seek to get this legislation passed. And the legislation has already been drafted and introduced. The folks that you're speaking to now aren't the leadership because that leadership has not yet been created of the five urban corporations that are yet to be stood up. It would be their prerogative to enter in those conversations with you. I think what Cecilia is saying is that we understand the question that is underneath your question, and that is, how can we work towards economic development that is in the best interest of our communities and the state of Alaska? And that's a conversation that we all want to have, because that's what we are trying to do in developing opportunities within our own communities. So I think it's important for there in this meeting not to be a misunderstanding that we're saying yes, but to understand that the leadership of those urban corporations, to our knowledge, would be open to having those conversations about how to responsibly use this land asset. Thank you.
Thank you, Nicole. Todd?
Any other questions?
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I would just add that there have been, you know, numerous other Alaska Native corporations that stewarded their lands, you know, very successfully under the state guidelines, and that I really want to emphasize, you know, going back to what both Nicole and Cecilia said, that, you know, as Native people, in how we steward these small portion of land that would be returned to us, but we have to look at it through the lens of our, you know, we are the original conservationists. We have values that drive and inform how we would steward these lands in perpetuity. That any sort of economic development or utilization of the land would be through the lens of, you know, protecting the waters and the water quality and subsistence and habitat. You know, these are all areas that are precious to us and that would drive the stewardship values that we maintain in perpetuity. So, thank you.
Member Mirchi?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Mayor. I think the purpose of the conversation here is to keep the dialogue going. I know this is a very important issue to a lot of people. I guess my original intent here was to, if this legislation was moving forward in a faster pace and everybody was comfortable for, at least have a conversation about it. It seems like we're going to have an opportunity, hopefully in the month of January or so, to have a wide-ranging conversation to answer these questions and have more dialogue. I know there's a lot of stuff left on our agenda here, and I don't mean to cut people off, but I didn't want to go too late here, and I wanted to make sure that Cecilia and Todd and Nicole had an opportunity to chat and let us know some of their concerns and answer some of the questions. But I think, you know, we could probably do it for another hour or two easy on answering all the questions that the community has. And I'm just wondering if we could hopefully wrap it up maybe on one end. And
I don't know how much more Suya and her people have to talk about. I don't know if you have answers to more questions that you felt were asked of you, but like I said before we started this, I think this is going to be a conversation we will have more of in the future, and I think the public needs to be involved in all of it. Besides just the assembly and the representative from the Landless Coalition, I would like to see representatives from, you know, congressional people and people from other communities. This is a region-wide issue, and I wish these discussions would have been had way prior to this bill getting to this point. But here we are, and we'll see where it progresses from here. I understand. I know it's been introduced in the Senate, not in the House yet. So, but we'll see. Do you guys have any other comments that you would like to make, Suya or Todd or Nicole?
Cecilia, if I may, yes, I'd simply like to make one comment before ceding the floor to Cecilia for closing, and that is that when the work of the Alaska Natives Without Lands group submitted its testimony, we did so along with 352 individual letters of support and over 1,300 letters of support from organizations, assemblies, councils, agencies, other interested groups.
Are you still there? Did we lose?
Hello, Nicole?
Looks like she got cut off.
Nicole has been dropped from the call, so until she gets back. Celia, you have comments or Todd?
Mr. Mayor, just a couple of quick points. You mentioned that the bill had not been introduced in the House. There was a companion bill introduced in the House 2 days after the Senate bill was introduced. It's House bill. It's H.R. 8751 with the same language, language related to the Senate bill. So just for clarification there.
Okay.
And just as it relates to...
What was the number of that bill? We have it written down. Sorry, Tom.
Okay, H.R. 8751. But also just written, again, wanted to extend my appreciation for the continued dialogue. We were able to come before this assembly as much as a year ago as we embarked on the Alaska Natives Without Land effort to build awareness about the pending legislation. The Petersburg Assembly, you were the first to post to your website the draft legislation, the maps with the proposed land nominations, I think as far back as about 3 months ago. So we really appreciated your efforts to build both public awareness as well as public comment. And I know many of the other communities have been following suit, but this has been a continued concerted effort across the region, across the state, and even down into the Pacific Northwest for more than a year now. So thank you so much for your leadership and for in inviting the dialogue.
Thank you. Is Nicole back on, or Celia, if not?
I'm here.
Go ahead, Ms. Tavolaro.
Yes, I'm here. I would just like to thank you, Mr. Mayor, and also Assembly Member Jeff Mucci for providing this opportunity to provide a little bit more clarification on our efforts. And like I stated earlier, we look to be good neighbors, and we look to benefit the whole community, not just the handful of shareholders, however that is the main concern, but all of the citizens of each of these communities, because that's how it is within the rest of the state. All those communities that do have corporations, we got stuck with corporations. This is the model that we are working with. So we're trying to make the best of it, and hopefully, you know, with the additional input and guidance and recommendations from our non-shareholder neighbors, it'll turn out to be something that's very good for the long term. You know, a lot of the environmental community at Tonga Futures Roundtable meetings in the past used to say, well, we want healthy and vibrant communities. Well, we do too. And this, we believe, is one of the ways of doing that. So we just would like to thank you for your time. I look forward to continued dialogue and clarifying some other concerns up that any of the members of the community may have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Have a nice Christmas.
All right.
Yeah, you too.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Nicole, she isn't back or she is back? Do you have any last minute thoughts, Nicole, since you were dropped from the call?
Thank you for the kindness of asking. I was simply emphasizing the amount of outreach and support that is already behind this effort, and I apologize for the cut, but believe that that concept has been conveyed. Thank you so much, and happy holidays.
You too. Thank you very much. Okay, that brings us to item 15 on today's agenda, new business. First item A is the assignment of lease, Marwin Incorporated to Rockies Marine Incorporated. I'd entertain a motion to approve this reassignment.
So moved.
Second.
Motion been made by Member Lynn, seconded by Member Mucci. And I mentioned this before, I figured out where it was, but I read Bert Winter's name in it, that I believe is the dock. And I would like maps put on, if it's possible, of the, you know, so it's easy just to look and you pick out the parcel and you know what you're talking about.
In
so.
The future?
In the future, yes.
Yes, sir.
Please. But is there any discussion on this?
I'm in favor of it, but I just have a comment that looking at that, the lease, and I looked at several others, and I've got received some of the public comments that I really think we need a clause in our leases that requires these people that we lease to operate the facilities. And if there's after a certain period of time, say 6 months or 1 year or what have you, that there is not, you know, just not being operated, then it reverts back to the borough and it can then be reissued. Because our purpose is to keep things in operation and to keep the businesses flowing in town. I'd really like to see some kind of a lease to that, or some kind of a clause in as we begin to, you know, renew these things and make changes that we put into our leases. Thank you.
Any other input on this lease assignment? Okay, will the clerk call the roll?
Jeff?
Yes.
Bob?
Yes.
Dave?
Yes.
Chelsea?
Yes.
Mark?
Yes. Next item under new business, item B, memorandum of agreement with Petersburg Medical Center to provide asymptomatic COVID testing to borough employees working at Mountain View Manor assisted living facility. I entertain a motion to approve this.
So moved.
Second.
Motion's been made by Member Mucci, seconded by Member Lynn. Discussion.
Mr. Mayor.
Member Mucci.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'd like to hear from Phil from the medical center, the CEO of the medical center, just kind of explaining what he's hoping to accomplish here. Thank you.
Okay, normally in this part, when we're deliberating as an assembly, we don't have input, but on this case we will. But in the future, I'd like to have all the comments put forward and visitors' views related to the agenda or some report of officers, so we don't have a back and forth dialogue at this point in the meeting. So, Mr. Hofstetter, can you answer Member Meeks' question?
Yeah, sure. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yeah, a little background is, you know, we just provided from our incident command group at the hospital a recommendation through myself and Dr. Heyer and a few others to consider testing staff on a regular or routine basis for surveillance of COVID. And there was some back and forth exchange with the manager, myself, with Shilin, and you know, I basically offered just free testing, just as a safety, just to get things moving. The result of that was this MOA. You know, I'm not familiar with all the reasoning or the requirements or the you know, why it's on the agenda necessarily. It was just an offer as a recommendation to support testing. And so that's where we are. The MOA just reflects simply our support in that testing and that we would be willing to do that for the manor.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Member Kinsinger or Member Tremblay, do you have any questions of Mr. Hofstetter while he's on the line?
Yes, I have one that if he could address at a future meeting. It's been brought up by several people that have, and I'm totally confused on the number of cycles on the testing and what exactly that means. If it's at the next meeting or at some point in the future, you could address that. It would at least help me and clarify what type of testing we're doing in town. And then my only other general comment on this is, well, I think it's very important that everybody get tested. I understand the controversy that's involved in that, and I don't know, I would like to see perhaps at this point with the opposition that is expressed by the members, or excuse me, by the employees, that we just, I'm going to support that we just recommend that they be tested, not make it mandatory. But I guess the question I'd like to ask, and I don't know whether Phil's the appropriate person, at what point would we require testing of the employees? When we have an outbreak in town, or when we have actual residents at the manor sick? With the employees at that point, would they feel it would be appropriate to be tested?
I can.
Go ahead, Mr. Hofstetter.
Yeah, I can partially answer some of that. You know, as far as when it's appropriate, that's really up. That's something that should be defined in a mitigation strategy for the manor. So it really is up to the manor, and also bring that up as a recommendation to the borough. I see would also be a possible track to help answer that question. You know, the idea is really to do surveillance and prevent that from happening. Once we're in a community outbreak, it's really very difficult to manage those situations in the moment. And to speak on the testing a little bit, I believe some of the comments are, and this is why I recommended the community looking and listening to the echo call, is because that comment is from PCR test is a bit twisted. It's I'm not a pathologist. I certainly can get our lab pathologist on if that's what's desired. But basically, PCR testing is looking at genetic material, and I believe what's being referenced is a comment that dead virus can be detected if in individuals who have had COVID. And then there's some, conclusion that's overly sensitive. It is certainly not a false positive by any means. However, it's a twisted conclusion in my opinion. But again, I can certainly get an expert, our pathologist on the line. Our lab director also addressed this at the last KFSK call. So, we will try to do anything we can to support education for the community, and including, if don't believe us, call the, listen in on an echo call at the state with the epidemiologies.
So, Mr. Hofstetter, in regards to Member Kinsinger's question, that would be appreciated if you could just send a brief explanation of the cycles and the from 15 cycles to 40 cycles and what the probability of accuracy is. That would be nice, but I don't know that we need to discuss that now, but it'd be nice to have that information. Thank you. Any other questions, Member Kinsinger, or did that answer your question? Or
Mr. Mayor, may I chime in?
Yes, I believe so.
That's it. We have Sheila Bell that would like to make a comment.
Yeah, I just wanted to reiterate the fact that not only is this not recommended by our state licensing, but it's not required at all under our state. Again, we are a home. We're doing the best we can, and we're going over and above. In fact, he said that it would be more harmful to probably do it because the false positives, he said, were not only possible, but they are probable. It turns everybody upside down in that. And the biggest fear for us too, the document that Teresa Phillips read for you guys earlier, out of 23 employees, 18 of them signed that. So that pretty much guarantees I might lose up to 1/3 of my staff, which would be way more detrimental. And so if we could just not do it, keep it voluntary, that's the best thing. I try to get them rallied up to do it. There's people that sign up once in a while, like I had reported earlier, but other than that, there's been no hospitalizations. We've had no COVID in our facility. There's been no spread in town. It's not required by the state. Just if we could just continue being diligent, like my licensing guy, expressed to us just what we're doing. He says, you're doing a good job. And when I talked to the assisted living homes around the state, they were not interested. I mean, they didn't do it. Just the one skilled nursing facility that was mandated by the federal government to do asymptomatic testing, that's the only one that did it. And she said if she could choose not to do it, she wouldn't do it because they're the ones that had the 6 different people, staff members, testing positive for COVID with no spread. And it was just a nightmare. But everybody else is just, it's all voluntary. Anybody else I talked to in the state. And that was southeast and up north out of Anchorage.
Okay, thank you for reiterating your comments from earlier. Member Mucci, you have a question?
Yeah, and a comment, Mr. Mayor. I understand that people feel differently about this, but, one of the statements that you made is that somebody that you rely on for guidance. I don't know if it's the he mentioned taking every precaution possible. You know, for me, I don't view this as a mandate. It says to me that this is an understanding that if people want to be tested up at Mountain View Manor, that they can be, you know. And, you know, I understand, and I've told you many times that, you know, I think Mountain View Manor does a great job. It's one of my favorite buildings in town. If my mother or father was living up there, I'd want to make sure that they were protected as much as possible. You know, I don't want to get lost in the weeds here, but I am just trying to understand how to keep things open. The senior citizens in this community are the most vulnerable, as well as the children. I take, like everybody else, I take this really very seriously. I think we get lost in this cycle, that cycle. But, you know, as far as I can tell, this is just the opportunity for people to be tested if they want. I mean, if people don't really want to be tested or be part of the protocols that we have in place, I mean, they have opportunities to do things. If people don't like the masking mandates that certain businesses have in town, they have options to do things. I mean, I know it's a very specified field up there, but, you know, I think for me, I understand their personal needs for the individuals up there, but for me, I look at this stuff as trying to keep the seniors in this community as safe as possible. And I, as I have in the past, I'm going to err on the recommendation from the medical professionals, and I am going to be voting for this memorandum of agreement with the borough. So thank you. I appreciate your time.
Member Lynn?
To me, there's two issues on the table here. One issue is approval of that, of the memorandum with the hospital, which would provide for testing. The other issue on the table, which is to me is not part of that, is whether or not we are going to require testing at the manor. And the two of them right now are balled together in my mind. And so I guess where I'm at is that I would move that we make it, I'm not in favor of mandatory testing at all. That if we're going to do it, I would move that we do it on a, it could be done on a voluntary basis. And that the manager all right now has a decision of whether or not he wants to require testing there. That's under the emergency ordinance. The other part of that is I'd also think that it could be moved into Carl's plan as to whether it goes from that to mandatory at some time, but not required at this point to be mandatory.
The way I read this memorandum of agreement is it is going to be mandatory. They just have to figure out a schedule if we approve this. Am I correct in assuming that? So it's just a matter of how many times they'll be tested and you know, what frequency.
Mr. Mayor, that's the way I understand it to be as
well.
Hold on a second, Member Tremblay, and then I'll recognize you. So I've kind of, you know, it's been, I understand both sides of the story, and this being required of the employees at Mountain View Manor, I will not support that, so I will not be voting for this memorandum of agreement. Another point I wanted to make, and I know the assembly and our ordinance that we passed, 2020-19 or whatever it was, decisions have to come before the assembly. In my mind, this decision could have been made from the administration through our manager without getting us involved in this dialogue. But here we are, so that's my position on it, and I suppose we could amend this back and forth and make it you know, acceptable to one side of the story and not to the other side of the story, and we're just going to be right back to where we were. I think what we've got going on now with get tested if you need to at Mountain View Manor. Clerk Thompson, you have your hand up for clarification?
Yes, thank you. So I just read through the memorandum of agreement again. I don't necessarily see in the MOA where it says that it's going to be mandatory testing.
Right.
It just says that PMC will provide the staffing, the equipment, and all the stuff to do the testing. It says that the we'll do it at no charge. It says that the testing will be located up at the Mountain View Manor facility. And it says that the parties will agree upon the frequency and that the borough shall provide PMC an employee scheduling notice each week. So I'm thinking that there would be like a sign-up sheet or something. And but Sheila also has comments. So anyway, the way I read the MLA, me anyway, unless Steve disagrees, this is not mandatory. It's just an MOA between the hospital and the borough to provide asymptomatic testing.
Well, then that's why are we having this discussion? I mean, in my opinion. Hold on, we have...
If I may answer that, Mayor.
Sure.
This is Steve. Could I answer that question?
You sure can.
Sure. Our attorney feels... Thank you. Our attorney feels that any contract must be approved by the Assembly. And this MOA is viewed as a contract. So I'm not authorized to approve it without the Assembly weighing in.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. And
yes, sir.
And this is... Okay, Sheila?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that PMC is already providing all of our asymptomatic testing. Anytime somebody signs their name up on my desk where it's been since March for voluntary testing, they write their name down, we set it up, and they go to PMC. It is better for them to go to PMC. Like my licensing specialist said, the more traffic you have coming from a hospital to an assisted living, the more likely you are to contract COVID. And we already have PT and OT, and it would just be another... I mean, if we can just continue doing what we've been doing, and I appreciate PMC supplying that, but where else would I go, honestly, you know, for the testing?
Okay, thank you. Any other comments? Member Tremblay, you had a comment?
I did, thank you. So some of my questions were answered by Clerk Thompson, because I agree, I've been confused about why people were calling in and talking about this as a mandate. The only thing I see is the parties will agree upon the frequency of testing of employees. And as we're hearing, there's already there's many opinions about that frequency and which employees would be a part of it already in part of the discussion. I'm not seeing any language in this MOA that does create a mandate. And I do think that it's important to bring the testing option to the facility because that makes it more convenient. I think people will be more likely to want to get tested if it's one less extra errand to run than, somebody's in the designated area. And I have full faith that PMC staff would take all necessary precautions to prevent spread in the facility. That's why we're all here, right? I have to admit this really weighed on me heavily the last week or so. I can't help but think about the residents there who are in our community's care through the hard work of the employees up at the manor and how we as a community really owe it to them to do absolutely everything we can to prevent spread from their living facility. And I see this as a step closer to that. And I thank the employees for all that they're doing. I do hope that it would be nice if the mitigation plan, and I'm assuming the manor has a stringent one already put together, would have, say there was widespread community COVID present, that would mean more people would be willing to get tested. I hope, again, that's not a mandate as a part of this. It would just be my hope that people would see the logic in doing that because of just how devastating this could be to our island, especially given the state of the virus in the state. So I guess I'll be voting for this. I don't, partly because there is no what I see mandate in any of this. It's simply making it easier and more accessible for the employees who do want to be tested. And I think that it's important. I actually see this entire conversation as frankly a symptom of the larger failed response to COVID in this country. If we had had regular asymptomatic testing for everyone from the get, or as quickly as possible, we're just now getting to that stage as a country. And that, I think, is why we're in a nationwide spiral where we're losing 3,000 people a day to a preventable virus. And it's just that we've numbed ourselves to mass preventable deaths as a country. And it's heartbreaking, and it's troubling to see, and the fact that we basically need to have a second version of scientific fact-checking for every assembly meeting now, because we have an hour of unvetted, unchallenged testimony from people that we as assembly members are not, we are not experts in those fields. It is not our responsibility to be countering those, and it's people calling in because they know that they can't be challenged by us the way that they are in the annual or the weekly KFSK updates. It's really frustrating to me, and so I'll be voting for this, and I hope employees take advantage of it. I hope that this makes it easier for them because, like I've said, my grandmother is in a facility now in Mercer Island, and if she were in this facility, I would hope that the people taking care of her would understand how important it is to go above and beyond to keep that virus from her, because she's worth protecting. And I know that they know that, and I'm grateful for all the work that they already do for our residents, and I know that it's appreciated by everyone. So thank you.
Member Mute, do you have another comment? And we need to
just a question, Mr. Mayor. For Steve, I guess. Steve, do we have a mandatory random drug testing program for borough employees?
Only if they're on a DOT safety, so commercial driver's license.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
Okay, we're going to have this. Okay, Sheila, I'll give you one more.
Okay, just really quick, I wanted to say logistically comment. For the PMC staff to come and do testing at our facility would be a nightmare, just because we have three different shifts. We have 23 different employees. We only have some people working some days. It would be much easier for PMC, who's listening, for us just to go down and be doing what we've done this whole entire time for the voluntary testing.
Thank you. Any other comments from assembly members? And I've been reading through this. I'd have to read through it again. I looked through it yesterday a couple times about the scheduling of the testing. It says once a week or sooner or quicker. If it's not, so I'm reading that into that, that if the level alert in town is going to determine how many tests the Petersburg Medical Center thinks Mountain View Manor residents should have. And maybe I'm misreading that, but I don't see the word mandate, but I see in the dialogue it's heavily recommended by EOC and PMC.
As long as it's voluntary.
Pardon me?
As long as it's voluntary, it would be up to the person when they write their name on the...
And that's the way it is currently right now.
Correct.
It's up from a testimony
Correct.
From Mr. Hofstetter earlier that it's offered to employees at Mountain View Manor, correct?
Not a specific weekly, bi-weekly. That could be an encouragement or a recommendation, but it would not be a mandate.
I don't think this is clear enough, at least to me, to support it. Member Mucci, one more comment.
Yeah, so there is nothing in here that says mandatory. This is all, if you want to go have a COVID test, you sign up and they will come up and they'll stick that thing in your nose and you'll walk away. There's nothing in here that says it's mandated. I mean, I have no idea where the conversation started that, you know, that we're going to make every employee of Mountain View Manor get a swab if they don't want one. There's nothing in here. I mean, I've looked at it till my eyes bleed, and I can't find it. I mean, and for people to make assumptions, you know, I appreciate people calling in and stuff, but, you know, when they say that this is just one step of mandating something and then the schools are going to mandate it, there's nothing in the document that we're talking about right now that says you have to get tested if you work in Mountain View Manor.
If you're going to set up for staff to be tested once per week on a certain day, the underlying tone was mandatory.
So without, this isn't clear enough for me to support. That's my last comment on this. We could, you know, go back and forth on this for quite some time, I think, without coming to a consensus of what it looks like to me. Is there any other assembly comments on this? So I would hope if this does pass that it just ends up being a voluntary thing, and if people at Mountain View Manor employees at Mountain View Manor don't feel like signing up to get tested for this weekly schedule or whatever they determine is necessary, that there's no ramifications from it. Member Lynn?
Yeah, I'm going to vote no also because I don't think it's clear enough. We rambled around here quite a bit and with different views. If we're going to do something, I'd like to see a very clear plan of what the intent is and why.
So maybe this could, we'll see how the vote goes. And is there any other comments before I ask the clerk to call the roll? Clerk, call the roll.
Bob?
No.
Jeff?
Yes.
Mark?
No.
Kelsey?
Yes.
Dave?
Yes.
So it fails with a 3-2 vote without having a full assembly. So next item on the agenda is authorization for Manager Giesbrick to approve preparation scoping document regarding the final aquatic center repairs and other improvements to the pool for an amount not to exceed $50,000. Manager Giesbrick is requesting authorization to spend an amount